Well, good evening. First of all, an apology. I'm sorry this lecture has been postponed and was rescheduled. Some of you came from a considerable distance last time to be here on the 14th of November, only to find the lecture was cancelled at the last moment. Both Noreen and I are extremely apologetic about that. It was the AUT Day of Action in London, and I had specially called the AUT the previous week, as had Noreen, to get union clearance to hold a public lecture on the 14th of November. And we were given clearance, given this is a voluntary activity, no charging, and part of a wider public program, as opposed to part of the normal events of the LSE teaching and so on. And so the lecture was scheduled to go ahead without any problem. On lunchtime on the 14th of November, late lunchtime on the 14th of November, the union changed their mind and said if the lecture went ahead, it would be picketed. And that caused considerable last-minute difficulties, not just for us, but for some of you, and we are very, very sorry about it. Well, first of all, let me say something about Noreen Hertz and the lecture this evening, and then hand over straight away to Noreen. Noreen Hertz is an author, academic, and broadcaster. Her official position is as Associate Director of the Center for International Business at the University of Cambridge. She began her career as a Russia expert and worked for the World Bank in 1992, advising the Russian government on economic reform. I think that was advising them on behalf of economic reform and some aspects of what we now call the negative aspects of economic globalization in its entirety. In the mid-1990s, she worked on the Middle East peace process with the Palestinian Authority and governments of Israel, Jordan, and Egypt. With the publication of her last book, The Silent Takeover, in Europe and the United States, Noreen Hertz became very rapidly one of the leading commentators on economic globalization, and that's why we've invited her here this evening. Her op-ed pieces have been published in The Washington Post, The New Statesman, The Observer, The Guardian, and she's a regular commentator to both television and radio. In fact, next week, on her lecture on globalization and gender, she'll be broadcasting about it before the lecture here in the evening on Women's Hour. A Dutch newspaper once referred to her as the diva of the anti-globalization movement, and I hope very much that means she'll sing to us this evening, but she probably won't. She is currently a visiting Miliband Fellow here at the LSE and continues our series of lectures on economic globalization and global governance. The lecture tonight is, despite the title, Corporations On, Not In, On the Front Line, and explores further themes we've already touched on in previous lectures, notably those touched on by John Ruggie when he talked about corporations and the UN's Global Compact. This is the first of two lectures that Noreen Hertz will give. The second one is entitled Women on the Edge, Gender and Globalization, which I think will be an extremely innovative lecture, and it's here on December the 3rd, again at the Old Theatre at 6:30. So join with me now to welcome Noreen Hertz.
Thank you, David, for that introduction. Well, it's been quite a few months for big business, what with the downfalls of Enron, WorldCom, Adelphia, Tyco et al., the numerous senior corporate executives arrested in connection with financial misdeeds, the seesawing of the NASDAQ and the Dow Jones, public confidence in business at an all-time low. And even Alan Greenspan, the chairman of the Fed, not usually thought of as a critic of big business, talking of the infectious greed that seems to have gripped much of our business community. Add to this the fact that multinational corporations are Europe's least trusted institutions. Below the church, the post office, your local newspaper, even the European Union, the media stories that continue to come out, the stories of the fat cats, Michael Eisner, the chairman of Disney, earning in 1 year $576 million, the entire gross domestic product of the Seychelles. The 85 multinational companies named and shamed by the United Nations only last month for helping to plunder the resources of the Democratic Republic of the Congo. the corporate takeover of the Johannesburg Summit, and despite the fact that, of course, there are many good corporations out there, it's not surprising that even the World Economic Forum, the annual meeting at Davos that world business leaders attend, decided to prove that it has its fingers on the pulse by naming the theme of its conference for 2003, Rebuilding Trust. If ever something needed rebuilding, it's the trust between corporations and society. But what is driving this climate of distrust? What are companies doing to respond to it? And why is their response as is? Why will that response never be sufficient? These are the questions that I hope to address today. But first, what are the forces driving or reinforcing this climate of distrust? Well, I would like to single out two: non-governmental organizations and grassroots activists, and how these impact upon public perceptions of corporations are as follows. Looking first at non-governmental organizations, pressure groups, things like Greenpeace or Amnesty International. Well, in the same way that companies are perceived as being untrustworthy, these are perceived as being trustworthy. In fact, people believe in them. They believe in them much more than they believe in either government or in companies. 76% of Europeans trust what Amnesty International has to say, versus 35% who trust in Coke, 27% who trust in any political party, and 26% who trust in McDonald's. And what I've been seeing since the mid-90s is non-governmental organizations increasingly leveraging this public trust and campaigning against those corporations that they perceive to be acting errantly or not to be upholding a public good. And 1995 was really the watershed year for this. This was when we saw a move away from government campaigning by NGOs to corporate campaigning. And Shell and Greenpeace was really the watershed case. And that's when we saw a very sophisticated media strategy where we had images bombarding the globe of Greenpeace tugs being rammed up against the Brent Spar oil platform. Public outrage, consumer boycotts. In one day alone, sales of Shell petrol in German petrol stations fell by 50%. And since 1995, we've seen an escalation of these kind of campaigns by non-governmental organizations. The Free Burma Coalition's 1997 campaign, the Rainforest Action Network's advertising campaign denouncing America's biggest timber retailer, Home Depot, the campaign to eliminate conflict diamonds, where we saw protesters standing outside of Cartier on New York's Fifth Avenue with signs with pictures of child amputees from Sierra Leone on them, with slogans saying, "Did your diamond do this?" Corporate campaigns, which according to all the main NGOs, are going to continue to be a large part of their strategy. Likewise, we see anti-corporate campaigns being undertaken by the group that I call the grassroots activists. These are micro non-governmental organizations. Often they are concerned about a single issue, things like a group that I came across in Devon who were protesting against supermarkets. And these groups really support each other. In New York, there was a conference a few months ago for grassroots activists, and it had sessions on brand bashing, culture jamming, and subvertising. That's when you take an image, like the Ronald McDonald image, and subvert it for your own purposes. And these groups have become a significant force because thanks to the internet, they can mobilize, publicize, go after companies with unprecedented ease. So we see anti-corporate websites, walmartwatch.com, chasebanksucks.com, mcspotlight.com, which gets 1 million hits a month. And we also have web chat rooms in which we see products being discussed, I came across a chat room in which Febreze, a Procter & Gamble product, was being discussed. Apparently, it's killing people's pets. Stories can be circulated to hundreds and thousands just by the click of a mouse, and because of the internet, customers, journalists, employees are talking to each other in ways never seen before, with big business finding it increasingly hard to stay in the picture. Unpredictable, creative, often funny, the grassroots activists, like NGOs, are a force to be reckoned with. And like the NGOs, they share an aim: to change the way the companies they target are doing business. And often, NGOs or grassroots activists do have success. Thanks to an alliance with the media, Shell did rethink Brent Spar. Pepsi, Kodak, Heineken did pull out of Burma. The Home Depot did agree to stop buying wood made from old-growth forests. The US diamond industry did agree to support legislation that would block US imports of diamonds coming from African war zones. And the email correspondence between Jonah Peretti and Nike over his request to have Nike stitch the word sweatshop into a pair of customized trainers reached over a million people's email accounts, creating a huge headache for Nike management. As Charles Kanachan, a leading labor activist, has said, companies live and die by their image. This gives you a certain power over them, a power which clearly can impact upon brand and reputation. But NGOs and grassroots activists are not the only groups who single out untrustworthy companies. So too is the group that I call the political shoppers. And these are the people who vote with their wallets on a whole host of social and environmental issues. We see the impact this group can have very clearly with the case of Monsanto, where following the launch of a campaign by Greenpeace against genetically modified foods, but in particular against Monsanto, a campaign which gained the support of mainstream media, ordinary shoppers, housewives, middle England, simply refused to buy genetically modified foods. And the impact of the politicization of their purchasing decision? Well, supermarkets saw sales in genetically modified foods plummet and took the products off their shelves. Monsanto's share price plunged from $51 to $38 as consumer fears spread. Deutsche Bank issued stark warnings to investors in genetically modified companies. Today, the term genetically modified becomes a liability. Investment ratings were downgraded, and Monsanto spun off its agri-biotech arm. And this political shopping phenomenon seems to be on the rise. 29% of consumers surveyed this year said that they had actually boycotted a product over the past 12 months for an ethical reason. 25% that they stopped buying from a company that they perceived to have been acting in a way that damaged the environment, with 75% stating that they would be prepared to boycott a product in the future. Okay, so these three forces, non-governmental organizations, grassroots activists, political shoppers, do all play a role in not only helping the public discern which companies to trust or distrust, but also in directly holding these companies to account by threatening a boycott of, or actually boycotting their products, or by threatening to harm a company's reputation. Yet despite the numerous successes garnered by these forces, it is clear that these forms of civil and market regulation, which is of course what they are de facto limited in their efficacy. Why? I would like to highlight just four reasons for this claim. First, only visible brands tend to be spotlighted by these forces. Invisible brands, secondary good producers, smaller multinational companies, companies that are not brand dependent, are able to slip under the radar screen. which means rather than a level playing field being created, with all corporations subject to the same set of rules, a whole host of corporations are just quite simply able to escape censure. Second, success by both NGOs and grassroots activists is predicated upon whether or not there is a market response to their campaigns on the part of consumers. But by handing over governance to the market, we risk those social concerns deemed most popular by their customers being those embraced by corporations in the West, with minority interests or unfashionable causes often getting pushed aside. Rights to freely associate, for example, are often not included in decisions by consumers on whether or not to buy a product, while environmental matters might more readily be. Third, we must remember that all this market-led pressure on corporations to deliver on social and environmental matters accelerated during a period of unprecedented economic boom. Customers, many of whom themselves were reaping the rewards of economic good times, proved to be socially minded, and even in some cases were willing to pay more to see a company dispense global justice. But now that we are in a downturn and cost cutting has become essential and emphasis on price is again paramount, do we not run the risk that customers' priorities will change and corporations' priorities follow suit? Will consumer politics become ever more just the preserve of the middle classes and rich, and in other cases, just wither away? Fourth, even if political and social shoppers want to factor in environmental and social issues into their purchasing decisions, they are stymied in so doing by a lack of sufficient information as to what companies are actually doing. Although most FTSE 100 companies do now produce very glossy reports, environmental and in some cases social too, well, these are well-nigh impossible to either monitor or assess. While, for example, in the year 2000, 45% of the top 240 global companies reported on non-financial matters, only 29% of these reports were independently verified. Market mechanisms rely upon sufficiently informed consumers to be effective. Uninformed stakeholders lack relevant information to hold corporations to account. Despite the spotlight effect, despite the fact that companies will increasingly do their business surrounded by the clamour of public opinion, and despite a number of successes on the part of NGOs and grassroots activists and political shoppers, relying on the market or civil society to regulate multinational corporations and to determine between trustworthy and untrustworthy companies will clearly never suffice. Which is why, increasingly, and very importantly, we are seeing attempts by non-governmental organizations and civil society to use the law as a way of instead holding corporations to account. There is a wave of cases currently taking place, for example, by developing country non-governmental organizations or civil society groups, hoping to use courts in the West, where it is more likely that rulings can be heard and enforced, in an attempt to hold parent companies accountable legally for negative environmental, social, and human rights impacts of their overseas subsidiaries. These cases either focus on corporate compliance with norms of international law, things like the alien tort claims cases that are currently going on in the United States, which allow foreign nationals the ability to bring civil claims against multinationals in the United States. Coke, for example, is being sued under the Alien Tort Claims Act for its activities in Colombia, whereby it's alleged that it was supporting paramilitary action to prevent unions from forming in its bottling plants. Rio Tinto is being sued under Alien Tort for its activities in Papua New Guinea, for its alleged complicity with the regime there over human rights abuses. Or alternatively, we see foreign direct liability cases, and these are cases that call parents to show the same duty of care at abroad as they do at home. And this would be something like the Cape asbestos case, where we had a British mining company, Cape, operating in South Africa during the apartheid regime, didn't provide any protective equipment or clothing to thousands of workers who are now dying from asbestos-related diseases. And this is a case which was taken to court and settled out of court for $30 million. And what makes these kind of cases so interesting and so important is that even if they're not won, the litigious acts themselves have a very significant impact upon a company's reputation. They can flush out revealing internal company documents. And this is something I'm told that the fast food companies are really dreading. It can uncover mismatches between what companies say they aspire to and what they actually do. And it can impact upon a share price of a company. During the Cape case, even before the case was resolved, Cape's share price fell substantially. Moreover, a growing number of institutional investors, pension funds, are increasingly factoring in the prospects of litigation into their investment decisions, given that litigation is viewed as an investment risk. So the Association of British Insurers, for example, which controls $2 trillion worth of investment funds, issued guidelines in October of last year, which call upon companies to disclose in their annual reports the social, environmental, and ethical risks arising from their operations. The threat of litigation can be pretty effective in modifying corporate behavior. But in addition to domestic law, what we are also beginning to see, and again, this is a very interesting and new and hopeful development, is an emerging patchwork of international standards, minimum acceptable rules, norms of behavior, and laws, which relate not only to nation states' international responsibilities, but also either directly or indirectly to those of the corporations domiciled within their borders or of their company directors. It has recently come to my attention, for example, that tobacco companies have been seeking legal advice as to whether their directors could be held responsible in the International Criminal Court for crimes against humanity, given the fact that their products are knowingly killing millions of people a year. And this kind of possibility is looking increasingly likely. International law poses a very real threat to multinational corporations and their directors. It allows rogue corporations nowhere to hide. Which is why international conventions that are focused on corporate behavior, like the Basel Convention on the Movement of Hazardous Waste, or like the Framework Convention on Tobacco Control, which is currently being negotiated, can be extremely feared. Moreover, the process itself of signing up to the convention is highly valuable. One of the good things about the Framework Convention on Tobacco Control is that 190 countries have been forced to get together for 2 weeks, two times a year, and face tobacco issues. The process itself has forced countries to examine their own strategies and internally debate between trade, investment, health, foreign affairs matters. So if international conventions and standards are such a good way forward, why are we not seeing more of these agreed to? More international standards imposed on multinational corporations? A global framework convention on corporate accountability, as suggested by various non-governmental organizations, for example, which would require corporations to meet the best environmental, social, labor, and human rights practices wherever they operate, and also be accountable for any environmental, and social damage they inflict. Well, the corporate lobby has clearly been onto this one and has been lobbying very actively against such international standards. Only 10 days ago, a group of 50 leading American environmental, labor, and public health officials exposed the United States administration's efforts to derail proposed European Union reforms to protect against hazardous chemicals, a strategy that clearly reflects the position of the US chemical industry. Despite the calls from a number of establishment figures for some sort of global governance structures to be in place, some sorts of international counterweights to the dominance of trade interests. Calls, for example, from Renato Ruggiero, the former head of the WTO for a World Environment Organization. Calls from Guy Verhofstadt, when he was president of the EU, for global binding agreements on ethics or the environment. To date, we have seen very little movement on this front. Apart from the 11th hour success at Johannesburg, that is, which thanks to NGO pressure resulted in the inclusion in the implementation plan of a commitment to the full development and effective implementation of intergovernmental agreements and measures and international initiatives and appropriate national regulations to actively promote corporate responsibility. In other words, a recognition at least that one of the ways to make companies act responsibly is through national and international legislative means. But despite this ray of hope, the legacy of Thatcher and Reagan, with its emphasis on deregulatory policies, a shrinking of the budgets of regulatory overseers, a conscious decision to hand over regulation to the market and corporations themselves, the Nozickian utopia of minimum states and maximum markets seems to live long. Socially or politically imposed restrictions on the market system continue to be seen by many as coercive and accordingly unjust. Regulatory bodies remain weak, and corporations are all too happy to keep pushing the line that regulation ramps up the transaction costs associated with regulatory compliance, promotes lowest common denominator regulating, and is bureaucratic. In fact, the very notion of corporate accountability has tended to be replaced by one of corporate social responsibility. Voluntary and self-regulation is what companies have lobbied for and basically have got. At our peril, I would argue. Because, of course, civil and market regulation is unable to impact upon corporate behavior en masse. And while the companies that do find themselves in the spotlight do tend to react to these forces, the general corporate response to all this has been, to be frank, pretty weak. A recent study of Canadian corporations, for example, found that the majority of large businesses operating there and the majority of large Canadian businesses operating abroad do not contain references to even the most basic human rights standards. Rather than a substantive change, and of course I'm generalizing here, there are of course exceptions to this, we see instead a change in rhetoric. So alongside the plethora of glossy reports, we now see a plethora of voluntary standards, codes, initiatives, multi-stakeholder dialogues, and private rating systems like the FTSE for Good and Global Compact, standards, codes, initiatives, which again cannot be monitored, and when they are transgressed, have no penalty attached. There are no high-profile examples I have come across of any remedial action being taken for breaching voluntary codes. While undoubtedly there are some companies that are using this climate to self-regulate to positive effect, John Ruggie highlighted in his lecture last term the case of Norway's Statoil, for example, reaching an agreement with the General Workers' Union to extend the same labour rights and same health and safety standards to all its workers all over the globe. The majority of firms, it seems, are only paying lip service to these universal norms, and instead free ride off the back of partnerships and initiatives, signing up to the responsibilities on paper, but using the partnership as a smokescreen for inactivity or irresponsibility. Take the much heralded United Nations Global Compact, which John Ruggie talked about. Those companies that have signed up to it are able to leverage their association with the Global Compact brand to very good effect. They're able to state that they have signed up to comply with the Compact's 9 core principles, which pertain to human rights, labour standards and the environment, able to get the reputational value that aligning with the United Nations brings. But there is no external monitoring or compact enforcement. The Compact has no mechanisms independent of industry to verify whether the conduct of its partner corporations comply with the Compact's 9 core principles. And the Compact Office no longer even lists its partner organizations on its website, making it very hard for citizens' groups to be able to follow what is going on. Even John Ruggie is aware of the free rider problem. Of the 400 companies subscribing to the Global Compact, perhaps no more than a fourth are deeply engaged, he says. Or take the widest survey of on business practice on corporate social responsibility, which was carried out on 500 British businesses last month by one of Britain's leading think tanks, in which it was revealed that only 4 out of 10 company boards discuss social and environmental issues routinely or occasionally. Only a third of organisations have a board member with an environmental remit, and only a fifth have one with an interest in social issues, and in which it was revealed that 8 out of 10 directors say that their organisation doesn't even publish environmental or social reports. Revelations which show all too clearly a gulf between the supportive rhetoric of corporate social responsibility on the one hand and the actual reality. To see voluntary standards, partnerships, or corporate social responsibility as an alternative to legislation is, it is increasingly clear, very misguided. But let's imagine that there was some great political will out there to deal with these issues. What could be done by our governments to improve corporate accountability, to ensure that we are able to discern between trustworthy and untrustworthy companies in a just way, to ensure that rogue corporations, unethical, untrustworthy, rapacious, are penalised for their actions? I'm sure this is something that we will come back to in the discussion period. So for now, I'll just put forward a few suggestions as to the steps that governments could take, both to improve civil and market regulation, but also to strengthen the law. One clear way, for example, that governments can help civil regulation and market regulation is to insist that companies make more stringent disclosure requirements. As we have seen, civil society and consumers are often stymied in their quest to hold corporations to account by a lack of adequate or reliable information about corporate practices. Governments should require their firms to report their own social and environmental practices overseas as well as at home. And we've seen some movement on this front in France, Denmark, Holland, Norway and Sweden, and also disclose the names and locations of the factories from which they buy imports or subcontract production to. Penalties should be attached to false reporting, and the government should commit to disseminating all information publicly, both internally and abroad. Companies that are found to have bad practices should be named and shamed, a practice that seems, where it has been tried, to work. In the United States, for example, when companies were forced or encouraged to publish sensitive environmental performance data, they soon began to launch emission reductions programs. Furthermore, the publication of this data enabled civil society and non-governmental organizations to increasingly benchmark a company's performance against other companies operating in key sectors. With regard to the new legislation that should be put into effect, I'll highlight just three immediate steps that should be taken. First, governments should not allow themselves to be bullied by big business into staying away from international standards and instead prove a willingness to make standards on the environment and human rights mandatory and not leave them to the providence of voluntary codes. Whilst voluntary codes can do a great deal to promote better practice, it is clear that the worst offences will only ever be prevented through national or international laws and binding rules. Second, directors of corporations should be held personally liable for corporate breaches of national, environmental, and social laws and international laws and regulations. And there are precedents in domestic international law of this. Industrialists in Germany, for example, were convicted at Nuremberg for using slave labor. And third, the corporate veil should be lifted so that parent companies can be held accountable for the actions of their overseas subsidiaries. It is absurd that, as the law currently stands, parent companies are not easily held responsible for their overseas subsidiaries' actions. But of course, strengthening domestic law here in the developed world does not address the fact that in the long term, it is essential that national legislation in developing countries works too. Otherwise, workers who are harmed by a domestic firm won't get redress, while their neighbors who work for a multinational might. Nor does the use of foreign courts do anything to build legal capacity or tackle public governance weaknesses in developing countries. And to this end, first world governments need to help developing world countries to build the requisite capacity to enforce standards and regulations through not only incentive schemes, such as the one initiated by the United States in Cambodia, whereby it has agreed to increase Cambodia's export quota contingent upon evidence that local labor laws are being honored, a scheme which it appears, according to the ILO, is working extremely well, but also through a recognition more generally that structural adjustment programs and IMF guidelines, debt obligation payments, collapsing overseas aid have left third world governments in many cases very vulnerable to the dictates of foreign capital and thus less likely or willing to take errant companies to court. Furthermore, we must also ensure that funds are in place so that workers and communities everywhere can be guaranteed access to justice. Litigation is, of course, very expensive, and either a global legal aid fund to which nation states make contributions or an independent foundation established with the remit to fund this kind of litigation would be possible ways forward on this front. Moreover, we must ensure that workers and communities have access to information, letting them know that these forms of legal redress are available and the rights that they have in pursuing their claims. But with all the emphasis on regulation and legislation, we sometimes forget that governments have a whole host of other tools at their disposal too. Fiscal incentives or disincentives, tax exemptions or breaks for well-behaving firms, the lowering of import duties, or the granting of special privileges to firms who adhere to environmental and labor standards. In Connecticut, for example, a new state law provides an expedited review of permit applications for companies shown to be adopting sustainable behaviour. Governments have a whole toolkit at their disposal that can enable them to reframe the costs of doing business so that the upholding of environmental and human rights does pay, and the damaging of the environment or the abuse of human rights does cost. Of course, in a world of global capital, as we have already discussed in connection with international law, there is a clear role for global and regional governance too. The European Union is making a few moves in the right direction, it seems, with its proposed mandatory environmental labelling program. Its Waste Electric and Electronic Equipment Directive, which requires producers to pick up the tab of recycling, with its annual parliamentary hearings into individual companies, and also with its general willingness to sign up to international conventions. But it could take a far greater lead in holding companies to account than it has to date. At an international level, the issue is again not just one of establishing voluntary standards, but the eventual establishment of compulsory codes which establish minimum labour, social, environmental, public health and human rights standards. And as we have already discussed, it is international conventions and international courts which will increasingly have to play a greater role in this respect. And it is so interesting to note just how scared the tobacco companies are of this prospect, with their inquiries, as I've already mentioned, about director liability at the International Criminal Court. And it's likely we'll continue to see calls for either a strengthening of ILO or UNDP regulations, or for the arming of labour, social, environmental and human rights codes with sharp teeth and credible enforcement capabilities. However small the win at Johannesburg was with regard to corporate responsibility, the summit has resulted in a clear opportunity to continue to call for and press for international mechanisms that would be binding and enforceable. Calls for action at an international, regional, or national level that, despite the continued embeddedness of big business and politics, will ultimately, I believe, be heard. Provided, that is, that the movements for these changes retain their confidence and continue their fight, which I believe they will. And why do I believe that the calls will be heard? Well, history teaches us that many a time they ultimately are. The anti-slavery movement calling about the abolition of slavery, resulting in the abolition of slavery. The Ladies' Temperance Union, which triumphed over the US liquor industry in the 1920s. Europe's Green Movement in the 70s, 80s, with its regulatory successes. And the Bush administration's response to the recent corporate shenanigans with a corporate accountability bill that is more draconian than anything we've seen since the Carter administration, needing to be viewed in the context of the fact that 82% of the American public were saying that they demanded stronger laws to govern corporate fraud. Governments historically do respond to public pressure by bringing about regulation. And ironically, this might actually prove to be in companies' best interests too, because in the absence of legislative enforcement mechanisms, NGOs, grassroots activists, and political shoppers themselves not only take on the role of global policemen, but also often judge and jury, which is, of course, potentially problematic. And while I do not for a second want to disparage the work of the many highly professional activists and campaigners out there, there is a question of who will guard the guardians, of who will hold them accountable, of who will ensure that they do not abuse their power, and the question of how corporations will ever know that what they are doing is enough. Questions that a more active focus on rules, on formal, codified arrangements that would hold both corporations and activists to a clearly defined set of standards would actually resolve. Shell, for example, has spent millions on environmental reporting programs, but still remains under siege from environmentalists who do not recognize these programs as legitimate. Nike, likewise, has now gone to great lengths to enforce its own code of conduct, a code that many activists still see as grossly inadequate. The problem is that without any objective standard for what constitutes acceptable practice, firms will always be at the mercy of their critics, and that without an objective standard, without any rules, firms are left bearing the burden of the response. And the smartest firms are beginning to recognize this. They are beginning to realize that in a time of rising public pressure, like this one, fighting the imposition of rules is a losing strategy. Nike and BP, for example, are amongst a number of companies that have begun calling themselves for clearer regulations. Indeed, in most cases, rules create a far better environment over the long run than uncertainty. Companies are better off dealing with clear and well-defined standards than responding to a host of diffuse and often contradictory demands. High-profile companies in particular are also better served by standards that apply across the board and not only to the largest or the most visible firms alone. Strange as it may seem, forward-looking companies can actually use public pressures to their benefit by anticipating the rules and not fighting them. Firms can not only protect against the activists' slings and arrows, they can actually gain competitive advantage and also perhaps, just perhaps, start the process of regaining that very commodity that we saw has become increasingly elusive, the trust of society itself. Thank you.
Well, in the history of Miliband lectures, this is something of a historic moment, a speaker who says that she will speak for 50 minutes and speaks for 50 minutes exactly. So thank you for coming in exactly on time. Well, traditionally we've taken questions in clusters of five, and I think we should do so again this evening. There's ample opportunity for as many questions as you want to ask. We can stay here for at least half an hour, if not longer. So let's take them in clusters of five. They're roaming mics. You just indicate you'd like to ask a question, and we will take it.
Yes, could you please give a few details about 85 corporations we are named and shamed by United Nations?
Please.
Yeah, I was wondering what you would say to smaller enterprises that might fly below the radar screens of these international mechanisms.
If you could maybe just explain a little bit more about international legislation. I know that a lot of firms have issues with it in terms of the idea that international legislation can be applied on a sort of one-size-fits-all level. So if you could maybe sketch out how that might look like.
Please, yes, up there.
I just wanted a point of clarification about something you said towards the end about Bush and his most draconian ruling. Just before, 80% of the American people called for laws that make corporations accountable. Thanks.
One more question up here. Well, I expect you to be thinking hard about the next round of questions. We won't be satisfied with this.
Do you foresee some sort of variables that would be factored into analysts in the investment community in their evaluation of these companies vis-a-vis corporate social responsibility or accountability as reflected in the share price. I mean, that is usually like a measure that's used to evaluate companies, so.
Okay, that's five questions.
Okay.
Work on more, Narina.
All right, thanks. It was recently announced that 85 multinational companies, including British BAE and Anglo-American and a whole host of other big name companies, had been actually identified by the United Nations for plundering the Congo. And this is part of the UN's kind of new move to hold some companies accountable. Smaller enterprises which can fall below the radar screen. Well, smaller enterprises, if we move to in the kind of corporate social responsibility arena, in terms of market and civil regulation, are getting hit and are changing their behavior to some extent if they're suppliers to branded companies who themselves are now asking more questions about their supply chain. So they're not completely necessarily under the radar screen at the moment. But of course, legislation, and we're not talking here about kind of, you know, loads of red tape. We're talking about some very fundamental rights being safeguarded, human rights, freedoms to associate, ILO-type standards, environmental rights, would also, if that was the way we went, towards a more kind of legislative arrangement, would also obviously impact upon small companies too. International legislation, one size, one of the problems that companies say is that it's a very cumbersome tool because it's kind of one size fits all. And you know, and that's used as a way to say it's better. Often companies will use that as a defense of why we should go for voluntary self-regulation rather than see mandatory legislation that's very cumbersome. It's kind of one size fits all. But you know, I think we have to, you know, and that argument is often kind of bought by governments who say, yes, you know, we kind of accept that. But I think this and it ties in with the question about the America corporate fraud, 82% saying that they wanted stronger laws about corporate fraud. I mean, I think, you know, when rich people get hurt in rich countries, then we do see governments who are saying, oh, you know, we're not into regulating big companies, kind of coming in and bringing about new regulations, the corporate accountability regulations in the United States. Whereas, of course, when poor people in poor countries get hurt, when companies there ravage the environment, move communities, harm people with labor practices, there we don't see the same kind of response at all. And to what extent are we going to see these kind of issues factored into investment decisions? Well, investors are actually the group who seem to be most, and I'm talking about institutional investors like pension funds and private equity funds, are the groups who seem to be most concerned now about these environmental and human rights issues. And I've spoken to a lot of pension funds, hedge fund owners, portfolio investors who are really concerned about these issues, even to the extent that one pension fund called me in and said, should they stop bankrolling companies? Should they stop investing in companies that were bankrolling political parties? Because did that show a future kind of reputation risk down the line? So investors, especially who are looking at long-term investments, are having to factor these issues in because they can't afford to take on that risk.
Another five questions. So far you're failing the question test. Please.
I appreciate your thoughts on what we can do, understanding that, you know, taking out of factor the political will that at present doesn't exist. I wonder what you think about the idea, this new idea of beyond volunteerism, which, for example, in the UN draft norms, which would be a declaration about human rights and the transnational corporations and other business enterprises, whether that's a realistic approach, understanding that right now political will doesn't exist. And also from a historical perspective, because yes, we had slavery, yes, we had other issues, but if you look at international norms, it's always been a declaration first, which is a non-binding idea, that then became a treaty or a convention that we could say is binding. So I wonder if you think this kind of beyond voluntarism, UN norms idea as a declaration first is actually a realistic first step.
Hello. The question I had in mind really relates to the last point you made. I was wondering your view on this movement, which are really sort of political shoppers on steroids, which are ethical investment fund managers who actually devote a great deal of time and effort to researching ethical investment of companies. What is the future of this in the context that you're talking about?
Back. Thanks. It was a question about your notion of the possibility of objective rules to govern both activists and companies. And I think a lot of people would have difficulty in seeing how they could be objective, and they might venture the possibility of an alternative to that, which would be the notion of democracy achieved through ownership, either share ownership or syndicalist systems. And you didn't mention that notion of ownership in your talk, so if you could just mention that now. Thanks.
Good question. Yeah. And then up.
International environmental standards can pose a danger to developing countries because they have less possibility of following sustainable environmental standards, as the tuna dolphin case between the US and Mexico showed. And also, there's also the danger of the imposition of values. For instance, you know, there are many first world nations that believe the dolphin is a species that deserves to be saved because, you know, for several reasons. What do you think can be done to avoid these circumstances?
And the fifth question up here. Yep.
As we all know, our governments are willing to deal with ruthless dictatorships over here. Yeah, so, you know, for example, with Indonesia during its time with the East Timor crisis, China with its numerous human rights violations, Iraq with Saddam Hussein. So my question is, in the long run, wouldn't corporations find a way around legislations by, for example, influencing political parties through financing their election campaigns?
Okay, that's five.
Okay. I think maybe you were referring to the UN Human Rights Code for multinationals, which is currently being drafted. There is work being done in the United Nations at the moment to have a kind of code on human rights, but pertaining to multinationals. And I mean, I think, you know, this is probably going to be a sequenced set of steps, and so it's possible that we will move from declarations to binding regulations. I think it would be very dangerous if we stop, though, at the declaration stage. So if it's a kind of interim point where we kind of where different parties can put input, okay. If it's the final stage, then I'd say we've made a huge mistake. Ethical investors, ethical investment funds, what is their role in all this? Well, $1 in $10 is now invested in the United States in some sort of socially or environmentally screened investment. Social investment funds, ethical investment funds, though a drop in the ocean, have trebled in size in this country over the past couple of years. So they're still small, but it is a kind of constituency that is growing in impact. And you know, there are things like the Center for Interfaith Corporate Responsibility, which manages $110 billion worth of church and synagogue money and uses this money specifically to go after errant companies and get them use that kind of power as an ethical investor to try and change the way they're doing business. And I think we'll be seeing more activity on that front. How do we ensure
that there's some kind of democratic kind of engagement in the setting of rules and standards. Was that the question? I think you raise an important point there, and I think it would be very dangerous if this were to become a kind of top-down process with rules designed in kind of bureaucratic cabinets somewhere, which were not actually inputted in to a very large extent by local communities, civil society, etc. And something like the Framework Convention on Tobacco Control, for example, is actually doing quite well to address these issues. They don't let tobacco companies play a part in their proceedings, but they do let non-governmental organizations, for example, actually speak and play a role in the debate. So I think it's very important, you're right, to get a more democratic take on that. The question about imposition of barriers, I think this is the point presumably about can these environmental and human rights standards be a form of protectionism on the part of the North? Is that what you were kind of moving to?
Mike, sorry, just coming. Just
in the tuna dolphin case.
In the tuna dolphin case, Mexico cannot afford to have the equipment that would avoid dolphins being caught, for instance.
Right. Yeah, I mean, absolutely. It's not a matter of just saying to developing countries, you have to have in place these environmental standards, which are the standards we rich countries already have, and if not, you're going to be penalized. That would be completely unjust. But it's a matter of saying there are standards that we collectively agree we should aspire to. How do we funnel aid so that it's actually used to upgrade these kind of standards? How do we use the development community in a way so that we actually realize these goals? So it's a commitment not only to having the standards but to achieve them in a realistic way that doesn't penalize them given their starting position. And then I never saw where the person was who asked me that question about dictatorships. Oh, okay. Yes, isn't there a problem that corporations can just influence politics and political parties through campaign financing? And yes, I mean, we see this in developed countries as well. I mean, you know, George W.'s environment policy, clearly shaped by the interests of American energy companies. And it's not a new problem. In 1876, presidential candidate Rutherford Hayes said, this is a government of corporations, for corporations, by corporations of America. And, you know, today the situation isn't that different. So that's, you know, that is a completely real question. And that's where civil society, of course, has, you know, an ongoing role to play in making a noise when they find out about these kind of things. And things like, and I would completely support, of course, state funding of political campaigns, of some of the obvious ways we could deal with this. There are some obvious ways. There are, of course, like ways that companies can get around it, but there's some obvious steps like state funding of political parties, restrictions on campaign funding that could be done, publishing of payments in developing countries like the program which Global Witness has launched, things like that.
Five more, a final five. So if you want to ask a question, now's your moment.
The foundation of your mechanism seems to be the involvement of citizens and customers, but how do you keep them motivated and mobilized even when their budgets are soaring and their attention seems to shift away?
Have you got that?
Mm-hmm.
Actually, it's going to be a final 10, I think. We're going to have a massive burst here of confidence from the audience.
Okay.
A mass 15, 16. Thanks. We have to do this slowly then. Go on.
Businesses have reacted to political shopping and so on by saying corporate social responsibility makes business sense. Do you think that we as activists, as consumers and as investors have made a mistake in arguing that there's a business case for doing things more sustainably? Do we need to do more to say there's a moral case that goes beyond any business case?
Question at the front. Irina, do you mind taking...
No, that's fine.
8 or 9, okay.
I may right. have to ask, come back to people if I haven't written it down in a way that I can read my handwriting. Okay.
Go for it.
Yeah, I just wanted to know what you thought the impact of new international regulations, if codified in law, would be on economic development in low and middle income countries, both positive and negative.
Good question. Yes, lay back. Coming up.
Yeah, hi, I would like to know, I noticed that you put up global takeover of the Johannesburg summit. I'd like to know what you thought of the corporate presence on balance in Johannesburg, whether it was more of a PR campaign or if it had the potential to be effective.
Anybody I've missed down here? Yes, please.
Yes, you've documented the negative impact on companies. You've documented the external negative impact on companies. Could you comment on the internal negative impact on employees, employee stress, well-being, families, and so on?
Okay. Nuria, that's 5. Do you want to take those, or should we carry on? The audience, are you happy to stay here for another round? Because I know there's lots of you who want to ask questions. We have time for it. We're not running out. Do you want to take?
If possible, I'd rather do 5 now and then.
Okay, we'll have another 5 in just a moment.
Okay.
And I have a question.
Yeah, very good question. How do we keep? Where did it come from? Somewhere over there. You. How do we keep citizens and consumers kind of engaged in all of this? I think it's very hard. You know, compassion fatigue sets in quickly, and I mean, even I, when I went to the protests in Genoa and I had to buy a new pair of sneakers, and I went to a sports goods shop and I thought, okay, I don't want to buy Nike. And then I just saw all these brands and I thought, you know, I don't know where this Adidas shoe is made, and I don't know where this Reebok shoe is made, and then there were all the brands I'd never even heard of. So even if you are kind of engaged and you care about human rights and the environment and these things as a consumer, it's very hard to act, which is why I ultimately do not have faith in civil and market regulation as the means of holding corporations to account. And that's precisely one of the reasons why I think if we leave it to citizens and consumers, it will never work. But of course, you know, just giving us more information would help. If we knew where something was made, it would help us in our shopping decisions. But you know, when price and costs become more and more important in a purchasing decision, then these kind of higher order things can often be traded off. The question from here about, you know, have we kind of got it wrong by encouraging companies to find a business case for this? Shouldn't we be telling them to do this for a sense of moral imperative? Well, that's what I thought when I started all this, and I had one of the most depressing talks I've ever given in my life was to an audience of 200 fund managers, and it was the first talk I'd ever given to like corporations, and I gave this talk which was all about we, the winners of globalization, shouldn't step over the homeless person on our street and just ignore them. And at the end of this speech, I was just met with, complete silence. And and then one person got up and said, "Let me tell you, I'd rather be poor in a capitalist country than poor in a communist country," and sat down. And I thought, okay, this is clearly not the way to engage this constituency. I thought the moral imperative line was the line to take with corporations, but in my experience to date, I seem to be having more impact on them by building kind of as clear a business case as I can. The impact of these kind of new international standards on low-income countries, positive and negative impact. There is the danger that we kind of touched upon there. That if these standards are just kind of imposed from above with no kind of thought out way of how developing countries are going to reach these standards, they will be punitive and they will penalize countries at a kind of disadvantaged starting point. And that's something that absolutely needs to be taken into account. But on things like labor standards, freedom to associate, the people I speak to in the trade union movement, tell me that it's people working in sweatshops in developing countries who themselves are contacting and trying to make links with people outside so that they are allowed to form unions, so that they are able to have a voice. So I think there is kind of a lot of grassroots concern about these issues, and people generally, especially if they're aware of their opportunity to have new rights, will want to take them. But so I think, I don't think countries can follow successful long-term development strategies that are based on abusive working practices, for example. I don't think that actually is an economic development strategy that in the long term makes sense. Because, countries need to be able to upgrade, they need to be investing in education, they need to be upgrading technologically. So I think new standards do not need to be seen as a barrier for developing countries, but we need to handle it in an appropriate way. Johannesburg, I think was, apart from this kind of 1/11th hour success, it really was the kind of corporate takeover of Johannesburg. And I think it was there that and you had all of these kind of initiatives being launched. There was that one with McDonald's and Save the Children, I think, or something, where they were going to give out hamburgers to give a bit of their money to kids. It seemed like a big kind of corporate PR exercise, and it was incredibly disappointing. For anyone who had expectations, I kind of hadn't even had the expectations. But it was also a case where America showed all too clearly under the Bush administration its unwillingness to participate in this international dialogue, with Bush's kind of non-appearance and Colin Powell's only very brief one. And the internal negative impact of a bad reputation on employees. I think like a half of graduates say that they would rather that they would not work for a company that they thought was unethical. Oil companies that I've spoken to, managers working for BP, for example, tell me that when they were working for BP at the time when the company was in the news for alleged human rights abuses in Colombia, they said it felt awful going home and having our kids say to us, Dad, Mom, why are you working for this terrible company? So, employees do not leave their values at home when they go to work. And if a company is found to have a negative reputation, that will impact upon morale, employee turnover, and there's been quite a lot of research actually on that specific issue.
Are you up for one more round?
Yeah.
Okay, one more round from the upstairs, please. There's plenty already. So, starting with the back, up there. Yeah. Are you waiting very patiently? Next, the mic is over there. No. Okay. Then you, and then you. Yeah. Well.
I heard something the other day. A friend of mine said that apparently some of the big companies are anticipating within the next 5 to 10 years getting places on the UN and in these multilateral institutions that we traditionally associate with government and the state. And I was wondering whether that you felt that was happening, whether that was realistic, and what the implications of that might be.
Okay, thank you. You two when guys.
When you talk about IMF structural adjustment programs, what do you see as the future role of the IMF and the World Bank? And to what extent do you agree with Joseph Stiglitz when he holds the IMF accountable for devastating third world economies by pursuing highly contractionary fiscal and monetary policy on countries in recession, and also the effect of shock therapy, i.e. privatization at any cost?
Thank you.
What's your view on corporations being proactive on environmental and social issues and actually getting involved in the community and perhaps directing the community as opposed to looking at the downside and bringing them up to a sort of average level, perhaps if the goalposts moved slightly.
Two more questions up there, and then I'll take one from here, and then we're done. Yeah, you too. Yeah.
You've referred to the positive role that the NGOs play in the anti-globalized movement in the West and certain parts of the third world. I would like to know your opinion about the local NGOs in the third world countries, specifically in a situation where the civil society is weak and the state structure considerably strong.
Gentleman at the front, yeah. And then question over here.
Could I pin you down a little bit on democracy? Do you think, it seems to me that regulation of business is like a sort of central political issue, and do you think that it's more honest to say that globalization has created a need for global regulation and that in a sense you sort of kind of have to give up on democracy and diversity a little bit because of that?
Okay. Finally.
You said that there actually were some forward-looking companies anticipating government regulations and international frameworks instead of always fighting against them. Do you think, strategically speaking, that NGOs would be wise, or would you recommend or envision these NGOs, high-profile NGOs, increasingly joining up with these forward-looking corporations on joint platforms to further pressure governments to act? Or do you think NGOs' primary role should remain, as you say, policeman, judge, and jury?
Okay, is there anyone who would go home really unhappy if they didn't ask a question now? Yes, you, two people. Okay, well.
Thanks. I actually have three really brief points to make.
I think you have to choose your best question.
Okay.
We don't care if you're unhappy for two reasons. We just want you to be happy once.
Okay. The first thing is which countries are most resistant in terms of developing countries in this process? Because, you know, basically we, have them by the noose. I'm American. So the second thing is there a trend or any comments about in this process of criticizing globalization towards devolution towards localism and local economies, because we don't just want better corporations, I hope. Okay, and lastly, I don't think in terms
so
of
she's going to go home ecstatic, aren't you?
I don't know, we'll see. The implications of globalization now or capitalism, I think that comparing to other historical movements like civil rights, women's, I think it's more insidious. I don't understand how, I just sense it. So if you have a quick word on something about this, I'm very cynical about the United States. Anyway, thanks.
Finally, one last question.
Timor was put onto the media shortly after successful oil exploration. Many figures in the UNTAYAT administration who I talked to admitted that freedom was simply to guarantee oil extraction from there. Industry convenience meant that there was an end to genocide. A similar country such as Western Sahara has no such chance. So when government is playing lackey to industry and will placate civil society, are codes and laws an answer to a gulf in ethics on the rulership level when issues are hidden from the media?
And I have just one last question. Your whole argument is premised on a very optimistic point, really, that there's a virtuous circle between legislation and corporate development, or even corporate profitability. This is potentially a virtuous circle, that the 80s and 90s were a time of great shift from public power and public institutions to the marketplace. The shift is now untrammeled market forces and now understood more widely and through protest movements to be hopelessly unsatisfactory way of producing a balance between regulation and social issues, environmental concerns, and so on. So it's possible that this virtuous circle could be put in place. I mean, I just want to know, why do you think this hasn't been understood before? And what do you think are the major forces which block its comprehension? And what does that tell us about politics today and the real clash of interests? You're saved
David,
by the fact...
David, as the chair, you seem to manage to get in many questions
well,
with that last one.
I thought I should be happy too.
Okay. Right. Some big companies apparently are already anticipating getting places in the UN. What a frightening thought. And is this already happening and what are the implications? Well, there is a quote that I used in my book, which was the guy who was the head of the International Chamber of Commerce at the time, talking about the WTO, saying he didn't see why they shouldn't have a seat at the WTO. He didn't see why they, I think to quote him, should be entering through the servant's entrance. Although we don't have a formal kind of place for multinational corporations in these multilateral institutions, they clearly have a voice and they clearly have a place. If we look at something like the World Trade Organization, I mean, corporate lobbying is completely responsible, for example, of intellectual property being within the WTO's remit at all. I mean, it was the pharmaceutical companies who lobbied so effectively, because what is intellectual property doing in a free trade environment? It doesn't actually make any sense. So, you know, whether they... And I think some of them think that their association with the Global Compact is now them actually being, you know, very closely aligned to the United Nations. So, you know, I think it is happening, perhaps not as overtly as you say, and something we need to be incredibly vigilant about. IMF structural adjustment programs, World Bank, do I kind of broadly agree with the Stiglitz position on this, the problems with shock therapy? Well, I kind of cut my teeth on all this in Russia. And I was I was working for the World Bank at the time, advising the Russian government on its economic reforms in 1992. So I was kind of one of the people who was basically selling this neoliberal Washington consensus to the Russians. And it was being there, and it was seeing what, you know, looking at what we were actually doing, at the fact that, you know, we had this program that I was... you know, pushing, which was to privatize the whole of Russia's economy within a year. I mean, it was completely insane, and nobody was even thinking or caring about the implications that this would have for hundreds of thousands of people who were not only dependent upon factories for employment, but also for entire social services that these factories were producing, hospitals, sanatoriums, education. And when I raised these concerns in Washington, it was made very clear to me that these were really second-order issues, that the market would actually eventually sort everything out, the people would be all right, and the most important thing was really to get assets out of the state's hands, put them into the private sector's hands so that communism never reared its head again. And so, you know, I share a lot of kind of Stiglitz's concerns with these institutions, and I've been, I've done a lot of work looking at kind of impacts of structural adjustment programs and World Bank policies on those most marginalized and most excluded, and we see, you know, I'm increasingly convinced by the data, which seems compelling, that those worst off in society are becoming, in real terms, worse off as a result of these policies. The question about companies being proactive, what about companies who are being proactive on environmental and social things? You know, should we kind of, is that a positive? Should we encourage it? I think, you know, to a point it can be, with caveats. For example, if we started to count on companies to deliver these social goods instead of the state, I'd say that could be very misguided. It would allow the state to be off the hook. But in times of an economic crisis, would companies continue to be delivering these things? We saw this very clearly in Japan in the wake of the Asian financial crisis, where companies, you know, traditionally had provided schools and food and kind of housing for their workers. And suddenly the chairman of Toshiba saying, we are no longer a charity. You know, let's kind of rein all of this in. So, you know, I think it would be We should be cautious. And then, you know, do we also want something like a town in Hungary, PEX, which British American Tobacco has literally just branded? So there is the BATS Hostel and the BATS Theatre and the BAT Clinic. You know, do we want that kind of branding of our public space? What does that mean? Do we want a situation like in America where 12,000 American schools are having commercials played in the classroom by Channel One Network so that these schools can get access to money for supplies and education? So I think there are lots of questions that we need to ask ourselves when we go down that route, even though, you know, there can be, you know, companies can leverage their distribution abilities to distribute kind of drugs, for example, in third world countries. Shell put more money into social investment programs in Nigeria after all of its terrible things it did in Nigeria than, you know, most government agencies. So, you know, it's a case of kind of looking at these issues and having clear safeguards in place. Local non-governmental organizations absolutely, you know, have to play a role in this whole debate, and you know, and Ted Turner actually funded a program called Channeling the Outrage, and that was specifically giving funds to local NGOs in developing countries so that they would have the kind of capacity to be heard, and they will have to continue, they will have to play an increasing role in this whole debate. But they already are playing an important role and have got a voice in many places. Globalization has created a need for global regulation, and, you know, is this at odds with democracy? I think there are a few things to kind of raise with that question. You know, we've got the issue of kind of state sovereignty being under attack by multilateral institutions who can override nations' abilities, let's say, to safeguard. Was the question over there somewhere?
Up the top.
Oh, it's at the top, right. Oh, yeah. Okay. So we have, I was looking down there and somebody looked like this is not his question. Yeah, I think there's the issue of kind of, you know, state sovereignty being under attack by multilateral institutions like the WTO, who can, you know, disable, or NAFTA, which can disable countries from, you know, protecting the interests of their own citizens. So you have kind of that going on. And, you know, and global regulation will kind of in, you know, will constrain, yes, to some extent, nations' abilities to do things. But I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing. I mean, I think we can have a concept and a conception of democracy that goes beyond national borders, that kind of has rights being, that people being entitled to rights regardless of where they were born. And I think kind of we will need to, in a way, expand our notion of democracy at the same time that we expand our need and the recognition for a need for more global governance structures to be the counterweight to the thrust of economic globalization. Wow, this is where my handwriting is getting very bad. Would NGOs hybrid? Oh, NGOs, should they link, oh, it's over there somewhere. NGOs, should they link up with the high-profile companies who are doing things? Well, we're starting, I mean, we have seen a bit of that. We saw even at Johannesburg, there were some companies that linked up with Greenpeace over the issue of kind of pushing the Kyoto, getting countries to go beyond their Kyoto commitments. And some companies have taken on these kind of roles of quasi-NGOs. There was a case of Reebok, Levi's and Van Huysen trying to lobby the Chinese authorities to address the issue of freedom of association in China as a whole. So I'm kind of, I'm all for companies, you know, actually using their political clout to champion some things which are kind of positive for the world at large. But, you know, it is a, you know, NGOs also have to, you know, look at these issues very carefully, and, you know, the extent to which a company can then leverage the NGO brand in their general kind of marketing activities is something that companies can do and NGOs need to be aware of. But I think there are times when it probably does make sense. It shouldn't be something that is completely written off, I would say. But again, something where you'd want to proceed with caution. Are some countries resistant? Are some developing countries resistant to the idea of kind of international standards? Yes, absolutely. I think that's largely not because, it's for two reasons. Either the country has got some very powerful, undemocratic kind of leaders who are intent on protecting their own interests, and they don't really want anything kind of curbing their behavior. But more generally, I think they probably, a lot of the developing country ambassadors I've spoken to tell me that it's not that they're resistant to international standards, but they're worried about the issues that a couple of you have raised here, that is this not protectionism by the back door? And so we've already talked about the ways we need to address that. This movement compared to the civil rights movement or the suffragettes or things like that. I mean, I think it's quite fragmented. In some ways, it's a very fragmented movement. And I think of it as a very broad coalition, where on the one extreme, you have people like the girl I met in the streets of Genoa, Venus, who had kind of stars stuck on her eyes, who told me that she was willing to die for this cause. And on the other extreme, you have people like Joseph Stiglitz, who now, sees himself, identifies himself with this movement, or people like George Soros, the financial investor, who also identifies himself with this movement. So I think you've got this very broad coalition, which does coalesce over, I think, some shared concerns over political, social, and economic exclusion. So maybe that's helped you understand it a bit. And then, I can't read at all. I think I'm on yours, David. Legislation and are we seeing, am I like unduly optimistic that we're seeing this kind of virtuous cycle? Why hasn't this been understood before? What are the major forces which are kind of stopping this happening?
It's late, so I'll take a word on each.
I don't think I'm unduly optimistic. I think that, from all the, both from a historical perspective and also from, seeing close up the kind of impact that the protest movement is having on corporations, more, in fact, I'd say, than governments to a large extent, makes me think that we are going to see definite movement in this area. At the World Economic Forum meeting in February in New York, you can go to a session where you didn't have CEOs talking about the fact we mustn't ignore the voices of the protesters outside. Now, I know that that was all rhetoric, but still, that rhetoric wasn't even there a few years ago. So I think, this movement is having a real tangible impact on the way that corporations are viewing themselves and their futures. Why haven't we understood this need to go for international regulation before? Well, there was a time when regulation was much more in favor than it is. Then we had the whole kind of Thatcher-Reagan era in which, the market became omnipotent. And, and we have got major vested interests in whose interest it really isn't to see things change unless they are forced to, by a combination of public pressure, of consumer pressure, of protest, of people on the streets, a whole combination of forces converging. I think, we go back to that 1876, really, Rutherford Hayes quote. Today it's not a government of corporations, by corporations, for corporations. Potentially it's a world of corporations, by corporations, for corporations. But yet, I do think that there is some hope. And if we collectively kind of keep moving this agenda on, then I think we will see a significantly better world.
So Narina not only finished in 50 minutes, but she's answered 29 questions and therefore probably needs to go home too. So thank you very much.